With the California primary election weeks away, Proposition 1 is a source of tension for many, as Governor Newsom and supporters tout the slogan, treatment not tents. Many people on the opposing side say that it falls short on the mental health and housing fronts and will happen on the backs of Black, Brown, and poor people. Today we'll look at what it is and we'll hear from people who either live with or have served people with mental health challenges to see how they're voting on Prop 1 and why. In the first segment, Karen Vicari, the Policy Director of Mental Health America of California, breaks down what Prop 1 is and what's at stake if it passes.
So much is on the table with Proposition 1. If you read it, it's hundreds of pages long. To boil it down, it diverts services funding from the Mental Health Services Act. Funding that currently goes towards vital community-based services gets diverted away into what they call housing services. And that's really partly where the complexity lies. The Mental Health Services Act is incredibly complex. There will be significant changes to county budgets and how counties can spend their money. And the other half of it then is a bond measure that provides about $1 billion in permanent housing for veterans, about $1 billion in permanent housing for the unhoused population or people at risk of being unhoused, and then just over $4 billion to build brick and mortar facilities in accordance with the BCHIP program in California. And so that is technically that's inpatient facilities and a variety of outpatient facilities, including treatment, crisis, respite, wellness centers, a whole variety of outpatient facilities.
And you said brick and mortar. That sounds like a private contract, perhaps.
Yes, the bond portion is only for buildings, right? So it doesn't fund any services within those buildings. It's all buildings that will be most likely built by private corporations.
And so for somebody who knows nothing, they might say, well, this sounds really good. There's a lot of unhoused people. Many of them might have mental health challenges. What do you think?
Estimated to be over 180,000 unhoused people in California. The permanent housing that will be built by this, if we look at what's happened with No Place Like Home, which was authorized by voters in 2018, same amount of money, $1.9 billion was authorized under No Place Like Home, and they've built about 1,700 residences. If we compare that to 180,000 unhoused people in California, it's a drop in the bucket. And especially if we consider that it's well known that homelessness in California is largely because of a lack of affordable housing. Over half of California renters are severely rent burdened, which means that any large bill that they have puts them at risk of homelessness. So homelessness is going to continue to rise until we build significant numbers of housing. So people that say that this bond measure is going to address homelessness, it's not. And what people really don't understand is the significance of the service cuts. 30% of MHSA County service money will be diverted. So that's money that goes towards really important community-based services, outpatient treatment, wellness centers, peer-run services, which are known to be highly effective and very cost-effective, are going to be first on the chopping block. There are more services that will be cut, but I think that's the piece of this that people really don't understand. Is it worth it to reduce services for people that really need them to end up with 1,700 homes and some outpatient or inpatient facilities?
When I told the Yes on Prop 1 person who I interviewed yesterday about that argument, the response was, well, people doing peer health or peer support are privileged and they don't have lived experience and they're disconnected and maybe they think mental illness is glamorous.
I personally identify as a person with lived experience, but I also have a sister who is unhoused in San Diego with mental health and substance use challenges.
And she explains, it's a requirement for people doing peer support work to have lived experience. Gigi Crowder is the executive director for NAMI, National Alliance for Mental Illness, Contra Costa County, and the founder of Black Minds Matter 2. Crowder is cautiously optimistic about the potential of Prop 1.
I will likely vote for it because it's the best we have. Do I feel like he could have done a better job of designing it to meet the needs of the people who live with the most severe mental illnesses? Yes. But I think all in all, we failed in California around addressing the needs. And so this attempt to do it and give more accountability to counties to get it right makes sense to me.
There are some things, however, that give Crowder pause.
I don't think you really need to take from one pot of money that's never been enough to go to another pot of money. But some of the legislation will allow for us to have more accountability counties. And so I'm pretty sure we're going to hear from counties, we don't have enough money, or we can't do this. Oh, is it possible? I have felt for a long time that counties have not used the most effective approach to producing the better outcomes for people, especially those who live with severe mental illness.
And then just to break it down for folks, what is your understanding of what comes with Proposition 1? And then we can talk about parts people might want to do some extra kind of pushing on legislators in the future to shape more.
You might be aware of NAMI California being a sponsor, and we're an affiliate of NAMI California. There's in California, I think there's 53 affiliates. And so we're all our own 501c3. So if there had been the opportunity to kind of push NAMI California to lean more towards some of the things that we really truly want to have, like conservatorship needs to look different than it has. We need to do a lot of work around who decides a person is eligible for 5150. And then, of course, the biggest piece for a lot of the family members that we love is there will be more money for beds for individuals who have the more severe mental illness.
Why is it that while so many mental health advocacy groups are opposed, the National Alliance for Mental Illness, or NAMI, is a co-sponsor of Prop 1? Karen Vicari says she has a theory.
People active in NAMI are most frequently family members, parents often, of a child with a severe mental health challenge. But the parents have not themselves ever been forced into treatment. And they also do not have generally an education into recovery-oriented services and the effectiveness of them. And that's where the disconnect lies, is the parents want to do anything to save their children. And to them, that is locking them up. Where for us, you know, even though my sister is unhoused, I know from experience that locking her up is not going to help. I need to find her someone she can connect with who can guide her into voluntary services.
Amy Mortar is a nurse practitioner fellow with Lifeline and is part of the street team that serves unhoused people in Berkeley. She's still deciding how she's going to vote on Prop 1. She says there's a general mistrust of the system when doing any type of health or mental health care on the streets.
I mean, one of the biggest barriers is getting into mental health care. I mean, a specific way that Lifeline tries to approach it is that if you're going to be seen by street medicine or, say, at Trust Clinic because you're unhoused, then you're automatically part of a team that includes, like, a health coach or, like, in case management, and then there's psych as part of the team. It's not, like, outsourced to a different clinic, so that's, like, a really special and specific thing. Substance use is also a major part of what we are offering, substance use counseling, substance use treatment.
Are you doing harm reduction?
Harm reduction all the way.
She says trauma-informed care is the cornerstone of the work they do, and it's about meeting people where they're at.
Giving people autonomy of their care so that they can feel valued and that they matter and that their opinion about what they are doing in their life and how they want to lead it is actually really important, and we think that they should be allowed to do that.
I also spoke with a housing case manager who's likely to vote on the side of no.
My name is Marcus Injasang. I work for the city of Berkeley. I'm referred by different agencies in the city of Berkeley, different community-based organizations, and they have outreach programs, and they outreach different unhoused individuals in different encampments and such. And when they come to me, I help house them and keep them housed. It's really what my main job is, to make sure they maintain their housing.
Do a lot of your people have a mental health challenge?
Yes. I would say a majority of my clients have a mental health, diagnosed or undiagnosed. I'm not a mental health professional. I've been doing this long enough to know when there's some pretty clear signs of mental health. A lot of them do have diagnosed mental illnesses. I've always been a advocate of mental health resources. From what I have gathered throughout my work is that one of many root issues with homelessness and the unhoused is mental health challenges. And I think that destigmatizing mental health, more mental health resources and more mental health education is a very key component to helping to address this problem of homelessness. And so when I hear of any legislation that's going to divert any resources, mental health resources, in order to just have beds, it gives me pause.
Maurice Bird is a licensed marriage and family therapist who specializes in harm reduction services and does outreach to unhoused people. Bird says that he and many of his colleagues from the harm reduction movement will vote no on Prop 1, and he's worried about the logistical implications of diverting funds from already scarcely funded county resources.
San Francisco has always had a really high threshold for folks who need or could really benefit from hospitalization, even if it's just a stabilization.
Bird says that while 5150s are generally last resorts, he recently issued one to somebody who he believed desperately needed services, only to have the person turned away by San Francisco police.
You're asking San Francisco in particular to make a 180-degree turn. So you're going to ask folks who have typically decided that folks don't meet that criteria to start meeting that criteria. Oh, God, and let's understand whenever they start full swing, whenever we're doing these temporary conservatorships. Again, I don't know where they're going to house people. I don't know who are the treatment folks that they're going to send folks to. It's just hard to understand how this is going to work at all.
If you could design a program based on your 2 decades of experience in the field, what would you propose?
One, you completely lower, drop out the threshold for people who are getting to treatment. I dare you to call TAP right now, which is a treatment access program in San Francisco. Call TAP right now and ask them for residential treatment. Call them right now and say, I'm in need of treatment right now. I'm really motivated to go right now. What should I do? And I almost guarantee you, because I've been at this for 20 years, is that they'll ask you to call back tomorrow. We're going to put you on a list. So drop out the threshold. If you're going to actually divert money, put it into actual treatment beds. Do it for folks who are actually looking for it. That's one. One is we got to lower the threshold. Reimagine maybe as clinicians and as substance use treatment professionals how we work with people. We have to make stuff accessible. If I'm motivated to come in today, I need to be able to talk to a clinician today. That's why we have the model that we have, is so people can walk up to us on the street and now you're talking to a therapist.
What's your motto?
And the motto is that we want to be low threshold as possible, accessible as possible. And we want to meet people where they're at when they need it. We don't want to have people waiting to talk to a therapist. We don't want to have people waiting to access treatment. We want people to be able to talk to somebody that day. You know, so that's what I would suggest, is that you lower the threshold. You drop the threshold completely. It's almost like when we ask people, hey, I need you to change. Please change, please change, please change. And then they show up and they say, okay, I know we asked you to change, now I need you to hold on. That, to me, this is the biggest contradictory that we have.
Along with more accessible mental health care for those who are ready to receive it, Bird says safe drug consumption sites would be another next step. You're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA, and today we're deep diving into Proposition 1, hearing from people on all sides of the issue. Next, we'll hear from a family who's been touched by conservatorship, incarceration, homelessness, and poverty.
I'm blessed.
Yes, you are.
That's the voice of 85-year-old Gaynell Hamilton, who now lives in the locked section of San Miguel Villa in Concord, where she's conserved by the state of California. On this day, she's seeing her son, Robin Andre Flippin, after a decade. It's his first day in the free world, after being incarcerated at the California State Prison in Vacaville.
I'm glad to see you so much.
I'm glad to see you as well.
The other voices in the background are those of her adult children who are gathered around her bed.
I'm sorry. I was supposed to stay and sing.
Hamilton apologizes to her adult son for no longer having her house.
You got me. That's enough.
I told her I got her. I just was worried about where you was going to be.
Hamilton has endured many struggles in her more than 8.5 decades of life. She raised 6 children, mostly on her own, without an infrastructure of support. Later in life, when she married a man named George Hamilton, she became a first-time homeowner in Oakland. It was in that house that she cared for her husband when he became ill and her mother when she became ill. When the two of them passed away, Hamilton abandoned her house and started staying in various homeless encampments and popping around to visit her children. It was during this time, in about 2017, when Gaynell Hamilton got a diagnosis for bipolar disorder. When her children at the time felt ill-equipped to care for their mother, they turned to the state and agreed to have their mother conserved. But they say they didn't realize the permanency of that decision.
I'm Julia Ford. I am a 62-year-old married woman. I'm a caregiver.
Although Gaynell Hamilton's daughter, Julia Ford, is a caregiver by profession, she's forced to leave her own husband, who is disabled, behind and drive past the city where her mom lives to take care of another woman who lives in Lafayette.
My mother is still alive at 85 years old. However, she's not with me. She is conserved and in a skilled nursing facility.
Ford recalls how difficult it was to care for her mother before she had her diagnosis.
She would be all over town. Sometimes she would go and she would sleep outside with the homeless people. Sometimes she would come over my house and I would give her a place to stay, which she had her own place.
Ford can't help wondering how her mom's outcome might have been different if she just had access to mental health care.
I would often see her and I would put her in my car and she would go to my house or I would drop her off at her house.
Looking back, Ford thinks her mother might have struggled with depression and other mental health challenges for a long time.
I remember Mama, I didn't know what was going on with her, and I don't think she knew what was going on with her. She would be in the bed when I left to go to school, and when I came home, she'd be laying down in the same bed. She didn't want to comb her hair. She didn't want to do the things that a normal mama would do. She'd go to the doctor, and the doctor would be doing experimental surgery on her. They never got to the fact that she was depressed. Black people never wanted to say they had mental health problems. It was taboo to get counseling or therapy.
Now that Gaynell Hamilton's mental health has been stabilized with the help of medication and therapy, Julia Ford feels ready to take care of her mother. But she says the logistics of making that happen have proven to be difficult, as her caretaking and job duties have often conflicted with court appearances and appeals. Ford herself has undergone her own struggles with homelessness and chemical dependency.
Oh, yeah. I was hiding a rape that had happened to me, and I was working as a hairstylist. I was doing well. And I guess sometimes when you're hiding things that happen to you, it's just like any other sore or any other sickness. It'll come to a head and it'll burst. And so I found myself out there using drugs. And when I found myself out there using drugs, I ended up homeless and I ended up separating from my children, but it was all because I had been raped and had never told anyone about it. I had never got any work done.
Ford has come a long way since the days that she lived on the streets and struggled with chemical dependency, and she says healing was part of her journey. In terms of how she's going to vote on Prop 1,
I would say I would not vote for that because I believe that it takes a person. Alcoholism and addiction is a self-diagnosed disease. It takes people to diagnose themselves and to get help on that issue.
What FORD means is that it takes people to admit that they have a problem to get lasting help. FORD knows because she's done it. She used the Healthy Babies program to go through a 12-step program that, in her case, worked.
Well, I knew I could not use drugs and be pregnant. So I knew that I had to get some help. And that baby led me to recovery.
And you went to a 12-step program called
The Healthy Baby Project. And the Healthy Baby Project was founded by Majida Rothman, who was very familiar with Black infant mortality. And so she has started that program to help African-American women who were carrying babies who were out there using drugs.
FORD says that while both housing and mental health challenges are issues that can't be ignored for Californians, Proposition 1 isn't the way to go.
People have to come to their own senses, and the ones that are made to do recovery, they keep using. It's something that you have to do on your own. It's a self-help program.
And lastly, I spoke with the founder of Peer Voices of Merced County, who's also a person with lived experience with both homelessness and mental health challenges.
My name is LaTanya Richard. Tanya, I am founder of Peer Voices of Merced County, the Shane Street Project.
We're going to talk a little bit about your background, and we're also here because we're going to talk about Proposition 1. You're on the side of no. What makes you vote no on Prop 1?
They put it together without the input of peers and people and stakeholders that matter. They asked us for our opinions, our asks, what line items we wanted. We all met together over the last year and gave them all of our ideas. And then instead of them taking it and adjusting the bill, they went behind closed doors, wrote what they wanted, and then presented it as two different, and combined the AB 531 and SB 326 into one proposition. And it's going to hurt marginalized people the worst. It's going to take money away from peer organizations, community organizations. The housing crisis is not going to be fixed by Proposition 1 at all.
Talk about some of the line items that you'd propose. Like, what did you see and what did you ask for them to change?
We asked for them to keep peer respites, help build more into peer spaces. We asked them to get rid of the involuntary commitment part. We asked them to get rid of conservatorships. We asked them that if they were going to want to put people into facilities, make it voluntary facilities, to get actual housing, not hospital beds or not homes. You know what I mean? So we asked them to bring peers on as a peer advisory board to help with this implementation of everything. And they turned us down on every avenue.
Richard shared a little bit of her own backstory and talked about some of her ACEs, adverse childhood experiences that she carried into adulthood.
I am the youngest of 6 children.
She remembers fending for herself and being a caretaker at a very young age.
At like 4 years old, I was left at home by myself all the time. So I had that, plus my mom was an alcoholic and a gambler. So we moved every 1 to 2 years. We've been evicted. And like when I was 7, I came home from school in the 2nd grade and all of our stuff was out in the yard. And that day kind of broke me and made me want to be an advocate for people with housing. It gets me a little emotional just thinking about it, but it was weird. Just I had this like little like metal kitchen set, and seeing my little metal refrigerator on the sidewalk was just like, what the heck? And we moved in with my mom's ex-boyfriend, who was a horrible, horrible human being. So much so that 3 of my brothers fought him. One held a gun on him because of his treatment of me, sexual abuse, physical abuse. And we moved, and even after we moved out of his house, he came to our house to try to hurt me and my mom.
In adulthood, Lestard craved for a different kind of life than the one she knew as a child.
My ex-husband went to the army in 2003. Because of the way I grew up, I wanted to not be like that for my kids. So my kids were 2 and 4 at that time, so I went to a psychiatrist, just believing I just had depression. And I left there after telling her the same kind of things I'm telling you. And she told me I was bipolar and schizophrenic.
Richard recalls leaving the office that day with more than a dozen medications and a gut feeling that her diagnoses didn't account for her coping strategies she adapted as a youth living with adverse childhood experiences.
When I was little, getting left home alone at night, I would stay up because I was terrified. I would stay up until the sun came up. I left her office that day with 12 really strong psychotropic, antipsychotic medicines that waylaid my entire life. I'm a hard worker. And after that, I took to the bed from 2003 until like 2016.
Kids were young then, and you sort of felt like you missed out, you said.
My kids, I feel like they really missed out on the mom I could have been.
When Lichard started experiencing more symptoms related to her physical and mental health, she reached out for help again.
By 2018, I was so paranoid and shaky. I was telling my doctor, I'm like, I don't know what's wrong. I'm shaking. He was like, oh, it's the medicine. Let me just give you this medicine on top to stop the shaking. I went, I checked myself into a mental health hospital in 2019 and they tested my blood and they're like, oh, darling, you are so lithium toxic. I also have chronic pancreatitis and diabetes from Seroquel.
Finally, for you, you went in 2018. Is that when you turned to peer support?
In 2018, I was on opioids, addicted to opioids because of the pancreatitis and all the surgeries I had. I was literally on fentanyl patches, Dilaudid, Percocet, and OxyContin, literally all at the same time by the exact same doctor for years. So in 2018, I had a doctor and I was just like, I don't understand why the pain won't go away. And she talks to me like a person. So she said, you know, opioids cause referred pain and it makes your brain, tricks your brain into thinking you're in way more pain than you actually are, which makes the need to take more opioids. And I was like, what? Done. And I haven't used, been in active use since that appointment. I started going to the behavioral health center here in Merced County. The people there are so amazing. And it's weird because last two Saturdays ago, I met the one of the peer supporters that really helped change my life. She was a dual diagnosis coach. And she was really kind to me and helped me. And two of those people there saved my life. Peer support literally saved my life.
Lichard says she now has an updated diagnosis that's more fitting for her, which is complex PTSD and autism. And she's on three medicines, not 12. Today, she's a Medi-Cal certified peer support specialist who runs support groups for people who've been through similar challenges.
Had Governor Newsom's undivided attention or Senator Eggman's attention, what would you say to them? And what would you say to California voters who are going to have their time to vote on this measure?
This proposition is going to ruin the peer movement. It's going to ruin people's mental health. People are stable right now. That's what they're not seeing. They're not seeing the people that are not out on the street, the people that are going to work, the people that are making a living. Those people are getting our services. Those people are stable. Take that away, they're going to be more unhoused people. They're going to be more people using substances. They're going to be more people unable to get to those jobs. They're ruining it. They're not for the people at all. They're for themselves.
California voters will have a chance to weigh in on the controversial Proposition 1 on March 5th at the state's primary elections. That's it for this evening's news. I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.